we could get to the point when the only currency that you're allowed to spend is the one in your CBDC wallet. So before you can spend that, you have to move money out of your bank account or out of your pocket into your CBDC wallet to be allowed to spend it.
Ready to live at the higher vibrations, where peace, love, joy, and good health are the daily standard? That's what this show is all about. Welcome to Vibe. And here's your host, Robin Openshaw.
Hey everyone, Robin Openshaw here, and I'm very excited to do something a little bit different tonight and needed to pre-record this because my guest, someone I have been a little bit obsessed with lately and listening to every interview I can get my hands on, is Clive Thompson. He sounds like he's from the UK, but he lives in Switzerland, but has for many decades managed rich people's wealth, I believe. And now the reason I want him to talk to you is that you may know that I listen to probably 20 hours a week of analysis about the economy, the markets. What is someone like me who is like sitting on the edge of retirement to do to prepare for the Great Reset? The reason I want you to meet Clive Thompson, of all the people I listen to, is he gives the most cogent, understandable, realistic, and holistic view of the kinds of things. I've never heard anybody who will kind of make predictions about, well, this is how it could roll out. He's not glossing over that we might end up with universal basic income. CBDC seems to be aware of all these issues, but just kind of comes to a different conclusion than that it's going to be a Mad Max world and everybody wants to, you know, just end it. I don't get that from him at all. And so with that, thank you so much for joining us, Clive.
Well, thank you very much, Robin. I'm delighted to talk to your audience. I think your audience, are they in the United States, mostly?
Mostly, yeah. We have a few who are in Europe and a few who are in Canada, but they're all native English speakers. You're from the UK, yes?
Originally. I've lived in Switzerland for 35, going on 40 years now. So just a few words about myself. I'm now retired. I don't do anything for money, so nobody can buy any services off me or anything like that. But obviously, I'm very happy to point people in the right direction if they need any help. I started work at the age of 18, and I stopped work at the age of 65. And unlike many people who went along the road with me, I never actually had a day of gardening leave or a day off work apart from the official holidays that we used to get. So having done my time, I had to draw a line in the sand at a certain age, and that was 65. Of course, where I was working, I could have continued. But to start with, I thought I'd retire at 58, then I pushed it back to 60, then 63. And finally, I said 65, it's got to be. It's the official retirement age here in Switzerland at the moment. They're going to push that up, of course. But I took the decision to stop work then. And now I do a lot of talking to people on the internet about their finances, but I do that for free.
Yeah, and we so appreciate it because you're just providing a public service that we don't get anywhere else. I haven't ever heard anybody lay it out in ways that a layman can understand. I've already told you that my audience is not people in finance and banking and investing, but they might have $5,000 that they want to keep and not lose it. They might have $5 million. So can you set the table for us before we get into, yeah. I want to ask you about CBDC, UBI, where you see stock market investments going, what will companies look like? What about bonds? I've heard you talk about all those things, so I'm just teasing it for everybody listening, but can you just set the table for, in your four, you said you worked for like 47 years. Is what we're facing the worst thing that you've seen in your lifetime? And what would you say about the whole state of the economy across the Western world here?
Well, let's start with the worst things. The worst things are always the current moment, in my experience. So throughout my career, there's always been crises going on or about to loom. And at every moment in the investing career, those crises which are about to happen or that we are at that moment in time in seem to be far more important than all the ones which went before. And therefore, most likely to affect the stock market in a negative way. So people are, if you want to find a reason not to invest at any moment in time, the current situation, and when I say the current situation, I mean the current situation, whether it be 1975 or 1985 or 1995 or 2005 or today, will always seem particularly bad when you're in it. After you've passed the crisis, we look back on it and say, well, nothing actually really happened. It wasn't that important. But the crisis we're in today does seem particularly important. So it's a normal human feature to worry about the situation you're in much more than the things which never did any harm to you. So you could go back and look it up on Wikipedia or somewhere like that and find out, take any year, and you'll find there was always some war going on, political crisis, act of terrorism. It doesn't really matter. You take your stock market crash, or the interest rates were too high or too low, or the dollar was crashing or rising. You can take your year, and there's a big problem. I mean, if you take 2000 and the year 2000, 2001, we had in successive years the Enron and WorldCom crisis, which most of your listeners probably don't remember. Maybe they're a younger audience. But at the time, if you were around at the time of watching the news, it seemed like it was the end of the financial world, because every corporation in the United States and everywhere else in the world must be run by corrupt directors, or so it seemed. And people would never invest in the stock market again because it was such a corrupt system. After these two huge companies went bankrupt through corruption. But as it turned out, they were the only two who were lying through their teeth about the numbers, and the real world carried on. But then we go rolled into the next year, the year after, the year after year, there was a crisis. So what I'd like to say to your audience, first of all, is in the current situation, there's a lot of bad stuff going on. There's the Middle East. There's the trouble with China. There's Russia, Ukraine. So there's a lot of worrying stuff. And you want to find a reason not to do anything, you've got those reasons. But in all probability, 5 or 10 years, you're going to be looking back at it and saying the crisis that you're in 5 or 10 years looks much worse than the one we had in 2024. So that was the answer to your question, what's the worst thing I've seen? I mean, of course, in my career, I've seen some almighty stock market crashes. I suppose the one which stands out was 1987. In 1987, the stock markets had been rising steadily for some years. And it was in October, I can't remember the precise date, so I got 27th October, but in October 87. And we'd had a few very bad days on the world stock markets, including New York. The Friday was a particularly bad day. Stocks were down a lot. I can't remember the figure, maybe 5, 7, 10%. And we went into the weekend knowing that Monday was going to be an absolute disaster. Everybody knew Monday was going to be the worst day. Over the weekend, in the UK, there was the first and last and only ever hurricane the UK has ever had in the southern counties. It knocked out all the train lines, it knocked out all the motorways, the power lines were down. And come Monday, nobody in the UK, in London anyway, in the Greater London area, could get to work. It was just impossible. So there were scant staff at the stock exchange and the brokerage houses which were taking the orders. In those days, of course, the orders would come in by fax. There was nobody there. So throughout the weekend, from Friday evening through to Monday and all day Monday, the faxes were coming in from all around the world to London with instructing the stockbrokers to sell in London before New York opened, because everybody knew that New York was going to be a disaster. But of course, what people hadn't realized, there was nobody there to pick up the faxes. So these faxes were piling up on the desks and nothing was happening. So when New York opened, all hell broke loose. And I think we dropped at one point by 30% in one day. And then London opened the next day, Tuesday, and it was down 30% at one point. And all the stock markets of the world at some point during the trading hours, whether it be from Friday through to Monday to Tuesday, were down 30%, depending on the time zone they were in. Now, the way people looked at that, it was going to be the start of the next Great Depression, because the previous stock market crash, which everybody knows about, which is the 1929 stock market crash, was only half as bad as that. I think it was only down about 13% on the Black Friday or Black Monday, but 1929 was only about 13% on that particular Black Day. And the stock market crash of 87 was double that in scale of things. So that was going to herald in the next Great Depression, which never happened. So those people who made the mistake of selling everything, thinking that this was the warning and it's going to get a lot worse, ended up missing out on one of the greatest bull markets in all of history. But it was a particularly bad day, and it was hard to find anybody who would want to buy anything. It wasn't like today where you could do things on the internet, everything operated by telephone or by fax machine. And we did have something called the Telex back then as well, but there was no email or anything like that. So things did move a little bit slower.
So 15 years ago, or whenever it was that Washington Mutual went under, you had to go in, if you were a patron of the bank, you had to go in and fill out a form and send a fax. Now people can move money with a mouse click. So theoretically, things could tank really fast here in the US. I'm sure you're aware.
Yep.
Our national debt is going up by $1 trillion every 100 days right now. We Americans are very alarmed at the escalation of the debt, to where supposedly in 6 years, all the tax receipts collected will have to go to servicing the debt. So you can, again, lay it out with us, what's wrong with banking, what might be different in the past. But I believe that you think there will be a great reset where we literally shift to a different currency, CBDC. Tell us about that, what you think is going to happen here or could happen.
Okay, so for the banks, the greatest enemy is now the mouse. As you said, when Washington Mutual went bust in 2008, I think it was, it took several weeks for people to start to organize getting their money out. And in the case of Silicon Valley Bank, it was 24 hours when they took out many, many multiples of what would have been taken out of Washington Mutual. And if they'd gone one more day, I think the next day, if they'd not closed the doors, $108 million would have left, compared with a tiny fraction of that which left Washington Mutual. And it's not just the speed of the mouse in getting the money out. It's also the information flow or the rumor. So whether it be fact or rumor, if something starts to circulate very quickly, the mouse is what's going to make that happen. And you can see the opposite end of that with what's going on with what is known as the meme coins. You probably saw that there was a stock which changed its name a couple of days ago symbol to DJT, Donald J. Trump, as a Trump, something to do with his business empire. Of course, the price immediately became a meme stock, and it went up, I think it went up 30 or 40% the day before. Then the next day, it went up another 16%. I haven't checked today, but I'm betting it's up another 20 or 30% today, because the stories about these sort of things can move really, really fast. And in a way, it doesn't really matter if there's any truth in the story or if there's any value. All you need is a rumor to start about some financial institution, and the money can move very, very fast before we find out whether it's a true rumor or not. It's like sitting in a cinema. If you smell smoke, do you sit back and say, well, I'll wait to see if it's really a fire, or do you start to move towards the exit? Well, in the modern world, it's very easy to move toward the exit. You press the button and you're out. You don't have to wait to find out if the fire is real or not. And then you can always bring your money. If the fire wasn't real, you can always bring your money back to the bank when you're sure it's safe. So there are dangers within the banking system that money can move around very fast. But it's not just, I don't think that's a really big problem unless you happen to be one of the failed banks. And if you fail to get compensated by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. And I think realistically speaking, there's an expectation that irrespective of your balance, you will be bailed out. That's not a guarantee, but it's the expectation. At least all the investors of Silicon Valley were bailed out. I think it depends on the size of a banking crisis. If the crisis was very, very large and some very large banks were going under, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation's only got a certain amount of money. And the question would be, would it be able to get the rest? And how would it get the rest? And what would that do to the bond market? Because no doubt the Treasury would have to, the Federal Reserve or the Treasury would have to step in and raise a lot of money somehow. So that could be quite damaging to the bond market at the time. Now, you sort of jumped a little bit about the central bank digital currency and the possibility of a reset. So for the benefit of your listeners, I'm going to start off by explaining what is a reset. Ever since the beginning of time, currencies have gone out of existence and been replaced by a new currency. I keep a collection of old banknotes for the last 100 years or so, and there are countless banknotes in my little banknote book, which have got many, many zeros at the end of them. They're all completely worthless now. But for example, I've got one from one country where I've got the five, I'll call it dollars, it wasn't dollars, but $5, $10, then it's 50, then it's 500, then it's 5,000, then it's 50,000, then it's 5 million, then it's 50 million, then it's 500 million, then it's 5 billion, then it's 500 billion. And then it went out of existence very, very rapidly. And that took 3 years, by the way, in that particular country. It was Yugoslavia, just to say the name of the country. But it's happened over and over again in countries like Brazil, Argentina, East Germany, well, Germany as well, and Philippines. If you look around the world, you'll find that there were currencies which don't exist anymore. Japan, China would be other examples, mostly around the wartime. What causes a currency to go out of existence? Well, it's debasement of the currency in general. So governments have always, all around the world, have a tendency to spend more money than they can collect in taxes. It's the way you keep your population happy. And of course, there are wars to fight, and wars cost a lot of money. In the old days, perhaps there was a belief that if you won the war, you could pay off your debts with the plunder. That's what Germany thought in the First World War when they invaded France. But it doesn't always work out that way. The trouble is, if you debase your currency too much, whether it be because of war or because you want to have a very healthy social services system, a Medicare system to look after the sick people, at the end of the day, you end up spending more money than you can collect in taxes, and you have to borrow the difference. So in the United States case, and it's not just the USA, by the way, it's Europe and UK and Japan, all around the world, the central banks, the central governments are having to borrow more and more money to keep the system going, to keep the gravy train going. Because if they were to stop, someone's not going to get paid. And whoever doesn't get paid is not going to be very happy. So you can imagine in the United States, if they stop paying Medicare or if they stop paying Social Security, you'd have more than a lot of trouble on your hands. So this type of spending is called mandatory spending. There's no choice about it. You can't let people starve. So in the United States, about 2/3 of the budget is what they call mandatory, and that goes on Medicare and Social Security. And then you have 1/3, which is called discretionary, but of that, half of that goes on military, so that's not going to go down. The remaining 1/6 is what could be cut, but even if it was cut to zero, with the way things have gone, the debt in the United States would still be increasing at a very rapid rate. So there isn't a lot of leeway to cut, except with a great deal of pain. The other thing which could be done to get the books into better balance would be to raise taxes. But you can imagine there's a lot of people who wouldn't be very happy with that, particularly the people who have to legislate it, because they would be certainly part of the class of people who'd have to pay these higher taxes. So there's a great will to hope the system can carry on as is with no consequences for as long as possible and hopefully forever. But in a way, that's a bit like somebody who's got a credit card debt and you're juggling your credit cards. When one company stops lending you money, you take out a new card with another company and you pay off your old bills. But eventually, you reach the point where the interest expense is exceeding what you're earning, and you're now into a death spiral, a debt spiral, as the debt spirals out of control because you can't even control the interest payments and you're still spending money left, right, and center. And we're not quite there in the case of the United States, but it's very much the direction of travel if something is not done. Because as you said, there's a possibility in something like 6 years, it might be 10 years, might be a little bit more. I mean, if you look at the official budget, it's more years, but the official budget is generally overshot in terms of the deficit being higher than they forecast. So 6 years, it's entirely feasible in 6 years or by the end of this decade. In other words, that's 6 years away, yes, exactly, that we're finding the interest is exceeding the tax revenues, unless they raise the taxes or lower the expenditure somehow. A lot depends on interest rates as well, because if interest rates are somehow brought down or come down, and by the way, I'm going to comment on that in a second and say it's not so likely, but if they can be brought down, then that would ease the burden in terms of interest. And maybe for a second or two, I'll talk about the interest rates. I do believe it's likely that the Federal Reserve will cut interest rates for many, many reasons, and they could cut as early as the 1st of May, which is the next meeting. Most people don't think that is when they'll cut. Most people think they'll cut on the first, I think it's the 12th of June, on the meeting following. But I could go into it, but I think there are reasons why they should choose to cut earlier than later. But the trouble is, even if they cut the short-term interest rate, it's not doing anything about the government's borrowing need. The government still needs to borrow money, and for the most part, they will have to borrow through the treasury market, through bonds, 5-year bonds, 10-year bonds, 20-year bonds, 30-year bonds. And the public who buy these bonds has only got certain appetite, which means if you want to sell them another bond, you have to offer them a better interest rate than they got in the last bond, or they're not going to be terribly interested. So the question is, at what point does the buying public get indigestion? Now, I know it's a very, very, it's a huge market. There are many, many buyers and sellers, and it's a very, very liquid market. So it's a bit hard to see that you suddenly get indigestion one day, but it's not beyond the bounds of possibility that everybody suddenly starts to get indigestion very quickly. And if you compound that with perhaps some of the natural buyers of the government bonds, which would be overseas countries like Japan and China, who've already turned into slight sellers. They're not major sellers, but they're no longer increasing their positions in treasuries. They're reducing them. So your natural buyers are starting to disappear. So you're relying more and more on the international buyers outside of the sovereign countries. So that would be pension. You're relying on pension funds from all around the world to invest in your historic treasuries. You're relying on domestic investors. You're relying on the banks. And at some point, some of these investors are going to say, you know what, my portfolio's got more than enough treasuries. I don't really want any more. So when that happens, who's going to take up the slack? And I think the answer will be the Federal Reserve, because that would be called a pivot or a yield curve control, which is when you start to, a yield curve control is when you start to buy longer dated bonds to stop the interest rate from rising too much. So if we do get into a situation where the interest rate of the longer dated bonds is rising beyond a certain point and looks like it's getting unmanageable by the Treasury, there's a reasonable expectation that the Federal Reserve will step in. But where does the Federal Reserve get the money from to buy the government bonds? Well, the answer is it prints it, and it prints it out of thin air. So it doesn't really matter whether the Federal Reserve is printing money to flood the system with money, which is inflationary, or whether it's the Treasury, which is borrowing money to finance its spending. That money, that wealth is going to the system. So if you think about it, the government needs to pay some social security. So it'll come to me and say, Clive, can you lend me $100? So, yeah, I'll lend you $100. I want 5% for it, please. So suddenly I've got my $100, which is, I'm earning nothing. I give it to the Treasury, and now I'm getting to be richer, 5% a year. So I've got $100 of bonds, and I'm getting richer by 5% a year over the next 20 years because they're paying me interest. Meanwhile, the government's got that $100 I just gave them, and they're spending it on somebody else. So the government just got $100 poorer, and two of us hold $100. So there's $100 extra out there in terms of wealth. And that's increasing. As the more the government gets poorer by borrowing money, the more the rest of the planet gets richer by the same amount. And there is a certain multiplier effect on this because, as you probably know, the money can go around several times in the bank. I can take the money I've just been paid, put it in the bank. So I'm richer by $100 because I just received it from the government. But the next guy, the bank's going to lend it $90 of that to the next guy who's got the $90 who's going to spend it on something. And that's going to be put in the bank. And then the next guy's going to be borrowing $80 of that $90. So that multiplier can increase the amount of money in circulation quite a lot. And sooner or later, you've got a lot of people who are wealthier than they were before because the government is poorer than it was before. And the net result is those wealthier people are going to try and put their money to work in something. And it probably isn't going to be first choice in treasuries. It's going to be equities or property or Bitcoin or gold or some other tangible asset. It may be a home extension, for example, but they're going to try and do something with their money which is more useful than leaving it in the bank or in a government bond where they're on a hiding to nothing because the amount of this asset is spiraling out of control. It's like sand on the beach. It can be made available in unlimited quantities if need be. So what happens if the population starts to lose confidence in the currency, as is happening in Turkey, Argentina, has happened in Zimbabwe, and happens in, and probably is happening in many countries, which I can't name at the moment. So when this starts to happen, people try to look for alternatives. They try and deal it. So at the moment, the world, when this happens, will say, I want to be paid in dollars. So if you're in Argentina now, not many people are going to be overwhelmed if you want to pay your taxi fare in Argentinian pesos. They're going to say, well, haven't you got any dollars? They'd much rather have the dollar than they would the local currency. That's called Gresham's Law, where the people try to get rid of the bad currency and people try to take the good currency. What happens when it all goes wrong? Well, I'm going to talk about a scenario, and I want to stress this is just a scenario, but I think it might play out like this. And it's to do with the central bank digital currency. Now, as you know, there's over 100 countries in the world which are trying to bring in a digital currency. A central bank digital currency, known as a CBDC, is not the same thing as the money you have in your bank. A CBDC is a direct liability of the government's central bank in your country. So it's not like the money you put in your bank, which the bank can go and do what it likes with. So if I put money in my bank, they can take that money and they can lend it to a spotty teenager to buy an Xbox. But if I have my bank holding a CBDC wallet on my behalf, or have my CBDC wallet in my telephone, which is one of the ways you'll have it, you probably have the bank hold one for you, they can't do anything with that money because it's a direct liability of the central bank. It's like a banknote. There's only one of it. It can't exist twice. Of course, I could authorize my bank to lend it to somebody. That's a possibility. But what happens when there's a crisis in the society? Let's say some new crisis. There's an earthquake in California. Maybe there's a war. Maybe there's another pandemic. Maybe it's an economic crisis. People lost trust in the treasury market. Maybe they're speculating against the dollar. And we've got to the situation where the central bank digital currency is circulating, and it's circulating alongside the money in your bank and the money in your pocket, the banknotes, and it's one-to-one. So anytime you want to fill up your digital wallet, up until now, you can say to your bank, please move $10,000 or $100,000 into my CBDC wallet because I want to buy shares in Apple, for example, and quite probably will have reached the situation where all transactions have to be via your CBDC wallet. Why will that be? It'll be so the government can make sure you're not a criminal, there's no money laundering, make sure you're not a tax evader, make sure all transactions are properly somewhere on the blockchain, which could be taxed. Maybe they'll tax you at source as you do the transaction, but certainly the more and more the situation is going to become one where, because the central bank digital currency exists, because it's easy to monitor, because it can be controlled, they're going to want you to do all your transactions via the CBDC. You won't have a choice. So okay. Even though you'll have your own money, that's
all. Let me just interrupt to clarify something. You're talking about having money in the bank account and having a CBDC. And I believe that my mastermind members believe that we would be transitioning from dollars in a bank account to a CBDC. Having listened to you before, you envision a scenario where we might have both, and what's in your bank account is slowly coming over to your CBDC account, but losing value. Can you explain a little bit about that?
Well, I'm absolutely convinced that in the early stages, we'll be one-to-one with the CBDC, and the dollar will be one-to-one. It'll be like dollars and cents. 100 cents is $1, and $1 is 100 cents. So I'm convinced that, and that's the plan of all governments. There's no question about it initially. The currency you have will be interchangeable. It'll be the same thing. But we could get to the point when the only currency that you're allowed to spend is the one in your CBDC wallet. So before you can spend that, you have to move money out of your bank account or out of your pocket into your CBDC wallet to be allowed to spend it. So what happens when we go into this crisis of some description, pandemic or something which we can't envision, and the shop's empty. You're buying too much. Everyone's buying toilet paper. I mean, I'm being extreme here, but it's the old toilet. I don't know if you have that in America, but suddenly every time there's a crisis in Europe, everyone rushes down to the shops and buys toilet paper. It's sort of like there was a time when they bought sugar, but the point is the shop shelves are empty, or there's rioting in the streets, or maybe something different. Maybe people are speculating too much against the currency, and the buying power of America is going down overseas, so you can't buy Chinese goods cheaply anymore, or who knows. So they have to do something. So to stop this speculation, the government says, we're going to put a limit on how much money you can put into your CBDC wallet, or we're going to impose some controls as to what you can do. In other words, if you want to buy a house, you can move your money across to your CBDC wallet to do it. But if you want to use it to speculate by buying the Japanese yen or the euro or the Swiss franc, and you're speculating against the dollar, well, that's not allowed. We don't want you doing that.
Okay, so it's a tool that allows them a lot more control, and you believe that it will start fairly benign, and things affecting free speech. I've been canceled by banks and social media platforms, et cetera, and lots of us have. You're probably aware of that. In the US, and it's even worse in Europe, I know. And so do you see it as the CBDC must be presented to us as all for our safety and protection, and then it starts very benign, and then there's more restrictions on the flow of money? They don't necessarily get rid of cash in the beginning. Those are some things we'd love to hear about.
Yeah. The vast majority of countries which bring in the CBDC will bring it in with the promise that there's protections for the users, protections against spying on what you're doing, protections against devaluing the money, protections on controlling what you can spend on. So none of these ability things that could be done will be there, and there will be protections, maybe even enshrined in the law. But then you can imagine that perhaps they say, well, there's this terrorist group which is blowing up American interests somewhere. We don't think they should have the CBDC. Everyone's going to say, absolutely agree with that. Shut their wallets down. So their wallets are shut down. And then there are these Colombian drug dealers who are bringing all the drugs into America. And because you can't use any other currency but the CBDC, it's having to pass through their CBDC wallets. So we'll shut those down. And I don't think anyone's going to have too much of a problem with that. But little by little, the rules start to get tighter. Now, let's give you another example. Let's suppose that they're dishing out all this social security. And they think that the people who are getting it shouldn't be allowed to spend that money on drugs or alcohol or gambling. You can only spend it on food and rent and so forth and your children. So you suddenly find that you go down to the liquor store and you want to buy your bottle of rum or whiskey or gin, and you can't. And some people say, well, that's perfect reason. Why would we hand out money so they can spend it on alcohol or drugs? That's perfectly reasonable. Perhaps some people say that. But we're starting to get quite close to the infringement of liberties. Now, what if we go to the next stage and they say, well, we also don't think that people should eat too much meat because apparently cows are bad for the planet. I don't know how they get that, but I'm sure they're right somehow. Therefore, we're going to limit you to a pound of beef every week. And if you want to spend more, because your money's programmable, you won't be able to do that. And by the way, we'll also restrict how much you can use your car. We'll restrict how many flights you can take, because all of these things are, you've got your carbon allowance. If you use up your carbon allowance, you can't use any more. But you can imagine it could go further and further. What about if you happen to be politically outspoken? You don't agree with the presidency or the party in power, and you're on YouTube pontificating about how awful they all are. Well, who's to say they're not going to say, well, we don't like what you're saying, so to punish you and make sure you toe the line a little bit better, we're going to restrict what you can do with your money in your CBD wallet. It's very easy to do. It's programmable. We can confiscate it if we want, or we can fine you if we want. We can literally, if you're walking down the street and you jaywalk and cross the road in the wrong place, we can literally take the money from your wallet without even so much as to buy your leave, because we know you did it because we've got the cameras, or we see your phone and it crossed the road in exactly the wrong place. So you can imagine it starts to become little by little more and more of a dystopian society where control is through your wallet. But I'd like to just go on to a currency reset. Let's say that this debt in the United States carries on the present path. And I know there's a lot of talk that it shouldn't, but there's no action. So if the debt continues to rise on the present path, at some point something breaks and there's a panic and we have to start a new system. And the way you start a new system is with a new currency. It's happened over and over again throughout all of history. There's almost no currencies which existed 1,000 years ago. Well, there are no currencies of 1,000 years ago which still exist today. Even if you took 500 years ago, the pound still exists in a certain sense, but it's not worth, it's worth but a tiny fraction. But most currencies don't, of 100 or 500 years ago don't exist. In fact, most currencies of 200 years ago don't exist. So when things get out of control, you restart the system with a new currency. And that's happened in all kinds of ways throughout the history. But I think the way it will happen this time is slightly different from it will be different from what's happened before, because we'll have a way of doing it with the CBDC. They'll be able to say, from now on, you can't move money into your CBDC wallet. What's in your CBDC wallet's in it. And you're restricted to, well, not restricted, you're obliged to do every transaction that you ever do through your CBDC wallet. And your old money is left behind in your bank account. And when the crisis is over, we'll let you convert it again. But of course, that is a promise which will not be fulfilled. Just like when...
We were told by Nixon in 1971 or two that it was temporary, that we detached from the gold standard, and here we are 52 years later.
So many people do remember what happened with Nixon, but of course it wasn't the first time that America went off the gold standard. That was when America went off the gold standard as far as foreign governments were concerned. In particular, the French would like their gold back, and they were told in no uncertain terms, if we give you your gold, we won't have enough to give everybody else their gold, but you can have dollars for your dollars. Because America was still on a gold standard as far as foreign nations are concerned. And therefore, if you held dollars, you were absolutely entitled to get your gold, albeit only half as much as you were allowed to get in 1933. Because if we go back to 1934 and 1933, let's start with 1933. America was running out of gold because it was going overseas. because Americans were spending money on overseas goods and so forth. And there wasn't enough. America was in the Great Depression, and there wasn't enough gold in the system to grease the wheels of the economy. And because of that, businesses were going bankrupt. So people were lining up at the banks to withdraw their money. And the money was gold. It was the double eagle, the eagle being $10, the double eagle being $20. That weighs nearly an ounce. So they were taking their money out because they thought the banks were going to go bust. So this is when Roosevelt, on his first day in office, ordered a bank holiday, shut the banks to stop the drain on the banks, and promised everybody that the banks would all be checked for solvency. And if a bank would reopen, it was going to be a solvent bank and you could take your money back. So after the bank holiday of several days, I think 5 or 6 days that they closed, people started to line up at the reopened banks to hand in their money. Of course, thousands of banks never reopened, and the people who had still got money in those banks lost what was in the bank, unless you happened to owe the money to a bank, in which case you still had to repay it. But money did come back in, but it wasn't quite enough. So a few weeks later, on the 5th of April, 1933, Roosevelt passed the Executive Order 6102, which required every American citizen to hand in his money, i.e. gold, in exchange for Federal Reserve notes, which was a promise to pay him back in gold at some future date, but he was not allowed to hold the gold. Come 1934, 1 year later, the government was still running out of money and the Federal Reserve had all the gold. So the government sequestered all the Federal Reserve's gold in return for paper money, which the government had issued. So the Federal Reserve received these promissory notes, not payable in gold, but payable in lawful currency, because under the act passed on the 30th of January, lawful currency of the United States was changed from gold to dollars. Up until that date, dollars were just a representation of a certain amount of gold. But now, dollars were the money, and dollars represented dollars. They didn't represent anything except for the foreign overseas nations. They still represented gold. But if you were living in the United States, dollars were dollars. So the Federal Reserve handed over their gold in return for U.S. dollars. And that the next day, Roosevelt pulled the rabbit out of the hat, much to the chagrin of the Federal Reserve, because he declared that the value of the dollar was effectively halved. It was about 40%, 41% lower. In other words, he reduced the amount of gold in each dollar. So the Federal Reserve, who'd got these paper banknotes, missed out on that huge profit which accrued to the Treasury. And of course, that restored the finances of the United States. So Nixon's confiscation of the gold was not the first event. The first event was back in 1934 when this happened and Americans were deprived of their gold. And of course, we now know that if you had one of these $20 double eagles, that would be worth well over $2,000 today. So you've lost 99% of the value of your currency already. We're on the last 1%. So what happens when we get to the situation where you're suddenly told you can't, it's a similar situation, like then, you can't change your new dollars back into gold. What if we get into the situation where you can't change your dollars in your bank into central bank digital currency, when the only currency you're allowed to spend is the central bank digital currency? You're now holding two balances, your old dollars and your in your bank and your new dollars in your digital wallet. If you can't spend the old currency, it's effectively worthless. Now, you might be able to find somebody to take it off you at a very big discount, but that's rather unlikely.
And you think this happens gradually, much like inflation happens gradually. People tolerate it at 2% a year. When it hit 9% here in 2022, then people are screaming. They can't pay their bills. Now we have this new phenomenon in the last few years in the U.S., and nobody's tracking it, called buy now, pay later, where it's estimated to be half of what the credit card debt is of Americans cumulatively, but there's no statistics to look at about it. But people are buying cocktails on a buy it tonight, make three payments. from what Danielle DiMartino Booth says, who worked at the Federal Reserve for 9 years and wrote a great book called Fed Up. But you see that happening gradually, like the pot of boiling water in the frog. It goes in cold, right?
It could happen either way. I suspect it could be quite gradual, where they start to have a bottleneck as to how much money you can move into your digital wallet. So maybe to start with, you can move as much as you want, and then it starts to narrow down. You can only move a certain amount, or you can only move it under certain circumstances. That's a bottleneck approach. So your old currency still has value, but you've got to qualify to be able to move it into your digital wallet. So buying a house would be allowed, but certain other things would not be allowed. Or it could happen very suddenly, because we've suddenly had an emergency, a huge crisis, and an asteroid has hit the planet, or something has caused havoc on the planet, and we have to take emergency, immediate action. And you're suddenly told nobody is allowed to spend their own money because it's not in your digital wallet. But don't worry, now the government is starting from a debt-to-GDP ratio of zero, because the old currency is effectively defunct. So all of the old debt, from the government's point of view, exists in a defunct currency which can't disrupt the economy anymore. So they've got a debt-to-GDP ratio of zero, so they can immediately bail out all the old people, all the pension funds. They can give everybody a universal basic income if they choose to do so. They can look after the system citizens by giving them all a free gift to get them kickstarted in the new currency and make sure nobody starves. There's lots of things they could do. And even after doing all these gifts to the population, their debt-to-GDP ratio would still be pretty close to zero, as opposed to the well over 100% that we have today.
So you're saying that with 100 steps along the way, they could rather invisibly completely transfer us to a new system that nobody really revolts over. Am I right?
That's right. Yes, I'm right. You're right. Of course, there'll be some unhappy people, because these are the bank holders. These are the people
who
hold.
Tell us who the winners and the losers are. I saw you do that in another interview, and I thought it was really helpful. Like you, because you're talking about the governments being seen as, you know, the giver of the gifts. Let's make sure the poor people don't fall below the poverty line. So let's have universal basic income. It's now, I think, over 70% of Americans don't have $400 to. Yep. Cover an emergency. So that's a large majority who will be like, great, let's do it. And then, I don't want, you know, people to fall below the poverty line, not be able to feed their children either. I'm sure that I would embrace that too. But then you're saying there will be winners and there will be losers. And I have never heard anyone say these kinds of things. I'd love for you to lay that out.
Yeah. So first of all, the man in the street, I don't think he has anything to worry about, because the man in the street, as you said, he doesn't have two halfpennies to rub together. He's in debt. So he's not going to be too bothered, because he's going to, whatever little balance he's got, he's going to be allowed to convert it. And he'll get his universal basic income if they give him one, and probably a free gift to kickstart it, which is more than he ever could have expected. So I think the man in the street will be fine. But the losers will be that 5% of the population and overseas investors who hold the treasury bonds. Obviously it will include the pension funds who'll be losers, but they will be bailed out to some extent. So overseas governments who hold US treasuries, all around the world, people hold US dollars. So there's almost no place on the planet where the wealthy don't hold US dollars. So the foreigners who hold US dollars are not going to be bailed out. There's no reason to bail out someone who's not a citizen of your country. Why would you? But your domestic pension funds and your domestic citizens will be fine. But if you happen to be a millionaire, if you're Bill Gates and you've got hundreds of millions in the bank, you're going to lose that. And the man in the street is going to say, well, Bill Gates isn't going to go rioting in the streets and burning cars. And I'm not, because I'm all right, Jack, I've got my money. I can watch Netflix 24 hours a day if I want now with my universal basic income. So the man in the street is going to be okay. The wealthy who've lost their large balances, because they can't move them into their CBDC wallet, will be upset about it, but they're not going to go rioting in the streets, because they will still have other assets and wherewithal to survive, because they will earn their properties, their yachts, their equities, their shares in the stock market, their gold. They'll have things, their paintings. Not mine, mine aren't worth much.
I don't know if you've read this little book called The Great Taking.
I have indeed. In fact, there's a review of it on my LinkedIn page. I did a review of it a few months ago.
Very good. Well, I've reviewed it myself for our members of our mastermind, and I haven't seen the documentary on it. People who've also read it said that it doesn't really represent the book very, very well. But David Rogers Webb, who managed billion-dollar, scaled up hedge funds to $1 billion more than once, feels that he went and met with George Soros twice, and Soros said to him one of those times, he told him, great work here, you know, showing where this is all going, which is, you know, we own nothing and we'll be happy, but we own something on paper. We feel like we own something. He says, we're already there. He moved to Sweden because he felt like they had the strongest property rights. But he said that George Soros said to him, they will never let go of, I'm paraphrasing, the appearance of equity. They whoever's in control here, you know, Rothschild, Rockefeller, whoever they are, they're always going to keep a system going wherein the people feel like they own something. Do you agree with that? Yeah.
I do. I think we will. I mean, even today, we have our shares deposited with a custodian somewhere, and, you know, from one argument, we don't own anything because it's not in our physical hands. But on the other hand, you could buy them, you can sell them, you could get cash out of the bank, and you could receive the dividends. So as far as I'm concerned, if I have my portfolio of shares in a bank, I do own them. And of course, if I look at the Great Taking book, the theory is that in certain situations, you would or could lose the entirety of your investment because someone else has a greater claim on your money that you didn't even know about. So the example I think they gave was, maybe one of the examples was in the Lehman Brothers case, there were investors who had investments held by Lehman Brothers who had in turn deposited them for custody with another bank, maybe it was JP Morgan, and Lehman Brothers owed JP Morgan money. And when Lehman went bankrupt, JP Morgan said, we'll keep those assets. But the people who own those assets said, no, you shouldn't. They belong to us. They're our assets. The courts decided that JP Morgan could keep the assets on the grounds that it was in the national interest. And the national interest was more important than the property rights of the individual owners. But that was a very special situation. I don't agree with the decision, by the way, but it was a very special situation. And I don't think the vast majority of people are going to be faced with that sort of problem, because unless we have a wholesale collapse of the entire system, I don't really see that happening. Your property rights are going to be protected, but there could be some situations which are similar to the Lehman Brothers situation. But I think, by and large, if you diversify your assets across more than one institution and ideally across more than one country, you don't really run a big risk. It's a risk, certainly it's a risk I'm prepared to take. And whilst I do agree with what Mr. Webb wrote in The Great Taking as a possible scenario, I think it's being too general. I don't think it would play out like that in a general way. I think it will play out like that in some circumstances, but most people would be just fine.
Yeah, I didn't feel like he even said, here's what I think is going to happen. He was basically laying out that, hey, they already own everything layers. Yeah, so...
They've got it.
Yeah. Okay, so winners... Governments are winners.
That's right, because the government no longer has any debt and it can start to borrow money for all kinds of things. All that, those lovely spending programs, there's no problem now borrowing the money. So you can have infrastructure projects, you can invest here, there and everywhere to get full employment. If you think about all the companies on the planet who've just who've borrowed money, because most companies have borrowed money, and so they have bonds out there. Those bonds are now in a defunct currency. So they're pretty happy because they're booking a profit because the value of their liability has just gone down.
The people who are in debt are winners.
If you have a mortgage, and I want to stress this is not necessarily the case in every country and every circumstance, but if you have a mortgage, there's a reasonable chance you'll find it left behind in the old currency. Now, some people say they'll never let that happen because the rich will want to hang on to their, if you owe them money, they'll want to hang on to it. But let's just say the failure of currencies has happened over and over again throughout all of history. And in general, but not in every case, but in general, when a currency has failed, whether it be a slow failure or a quick failure, slow failure being high inflation, hyperinflation, quick failure was maybe some invasion and they had to change the currency all in one go. Like, for example, when the Japanese invaded Hong Kong, for example. In general, those who had liabilities in the old currency were better off because before the situation, they owned, let's say, a house and had a mortgage. After the situation, they still had the house, but the mortgage was left behind and they owed a currency which was now either worthless or worth much, much less. So in general, if you owe money, even if it's on a mortgage, you came out as a winner. And the same thing is likely to apply if you have a credit card debt or any other form of debt. So the man in the street, it's not a guarantee because it does depend on the laws of the current country, but the man in the street may find that his mortgage becomes worthless or effectively worthless because it's in a defunct currency, which is great for the man in the street because now those who own homes will be able to rehypothecate their homes to go on a spending spree. You know how people, when their price or the value of their home goes up, they spend it on holidays by repaying a little bit less of the mortgage. Why should we repay it? Well, our house is worth double what it is. We're rich. We can spend more money. So if your mortgage has gone away, people will be spending more for sure. They'll be spending the future value of their house. That's good for the economy. It's good for the well-being of the country and the people in it. It's good for taxes because, of course, the turnover of the country is going to go up. The government won't need to take so much out of your pay packet to service the national debt. So people might have a bit more spending money there. So companies will be doing well. The stock markets will be doing very well. I just perhaps should stress that it doesn't mean to say the prices will be higher compared with today. They'll probably be lower, but they'll still be there and they'll be rising. Why will prices be lower? Because if we have a reset, a huge quantity of the wealth on the planet will have been made worthless. Doesn't exist. So if you wipe out a lot of assets on the planet, everything which is left on the planet, priced in the new currency, because a lot less of it will be worth in the new currency a lot less. But we mustn't forget that a chocolate bar is still a chocolate bar. Shares in McDonald's are still shares in McDonald's. A bar of gold is still a bar of gold. So what you have is still worth what it's worth. In fact, it's worth infinity in the old currency. So you made a ton of money. In the new currency, it might be worth a half or a quarter of of the old price. So it depends on how you look at it, whether you've lost money or gained money. The wealthy will say, who keep score in the old currency, will say, I'm a lot richer because the old currency has gone to nothing. But in the new currency, they'll be a lot poorer.
Okay, so let me clarify something because, you know, I come from a culture where we prepared. My parents, we lived below the poverty line, family of 10. I'm the oldest of 8 children, but the religion I was raised in, we stored a year's supply of food. And that was just, you just did that. And you tried to work it in to use that food and then just keep replacing it. But a chocolate bar goes bad. I remember in my 20s, following the example of my parents and the religion, I remember buying a case of cigarettes, even though I've never smoked, because I thought they would be good for barter. I didn't know that cigarettes go bad in a year or two. So, you know, somebody while I was moving took the case of cigarettes and that's fine. But, you know, I think that what you recommend for those of us who are very concerned about how we are sitting on the edge of a cliff here is to buy things now in today's dollars before they're worth less, especially if it's not a chocolate bar that 6 months from now is going to be gray and moldy and you won't want to eat it. So buy the things that will go the distance. I've been saying that since 2021 when we started this mastermind, is buy the things in today's dollars. I have an extra water heater and an extra washer and dryer, and I'm not sorry, but I have space for it. I have a place for it. Not everyone can do that, and that obviously doesn't make sense for everyone, but you're a fan of, when you're investing for the Great Reset, you're a fan of what? Gold, silver, things that are going to get more expensive, yes?
Everything depends on how much you've got. The more you have, the more you should be looking at investing in financial type assets, such as gold, such as equities, such as property, Bitcoin, silver, and maybe if you're very ultra rich, you're looking at works of art, antiques, rare items, things like that. But what about the man in the street who's low down the scale, but still feels he maybe has too much to qualify for the beneficial treatment that the average guy gets? Well, what I'd say to him is, perhaps you need a home extension. You could do that, or a loft conversion. Perhaps you're planning to do some exercise next year. Your wife's been nagging you about doing some exercise. You haven't got around to it. Well, you could at least buy the exercise machine now, even if you don't plan to start until next year. You could buy the presents for the grandchildren now, for next year.
So I think we need to do a little cleanup on something you said before, because when people started talking about debt jubilee, which I didn't really know much about it from history, I knew that fiat currencies have all failed. They last a couple hundred years if it's a stronger one, but they've all failed. All the currencies of the world, yours in Switzerland was the last to depeg from the dollar in 1999. That you're not, when there's a debt jubilee, it doesn't mean, okay, we were playing the game of musical chairs, whatever house you're in, you get it for free forever. It's there's some kind of shift where you might be better off, I believe is what you're saying. And a Great Reset could actually really stimulate the economy and leave the economy mostly intact. The stock market, et cetera, I believe is what you say. But you are not going to just get your mortgage wiped out and you get the house you get and now it's free. That's not what you're saying, right? Because people were talking about Nisara and Jisara and debt jubilees. And I think people thought that their debt would all be wiped out. What do you have to say about that?
So your debt is not forgiven. Your debt is just worth less or worth nothing because the currency's gone to zero. So it all depends on how quickly this happens, when it happens, and what way it happens. But as a general rule, if you owe money in a currency which is going downhill, you owe less and less. So I'll give you a very easy example, which is easy to understand. As you know, in Argentina, the inflation rate is very high. It's in the hundreds of percent. So those who had the good fortune to borrow 4 or 5 years ago at a lower interest rate, and they had their interest rate fixed, now owe to the bank almost nothing compared to the value of their house today, because the house has been doubling every year as the inflation has been 100%. But what they owe has not been doubling because it's a fixed amount. So in a debt, so it's not really a debt jubilee where you're forgiven the debts, although people like to call it that. It's more of a situation where the debts which you do owe are worth either much, much less or nothing at all, because it becomes completely pointless in repaying them. And I should stress, we don't know how it will play out in each country if it happens this way. I'm going to give you an example. When Eastern Germany merged with Western Germany, people had loans and mortgages in Eastern German marks. I believe that the way it worked there was that part of the debt was left behind, in other words, worthless, but part had to now be repaid to the banks in the new currency. They did it that way to sort of keep the banks going, because they wanted the banking system to continue to run. Otherwise, if you basically make all the old money worthless, the banks are defunct. They're not needed anymore. But perhaps we won't need the banks, at least we won't need them for the taking of deposits and lending, if we're running on the CBDC. So maybe they'll let that go next time. I don't know. But my message is, if you want to be a winner, buy tangible assets. If you want to be a loser, have a very large time deposit or a bond or a money market fund.
Got it. So you're not in a white hot panic about this. You are one of the calmest voices I've heard in all of this. You see their path forward. You see them making progress toward it. Am I wrong? Do you feel like there's going to be pain and suffering and there's going to be winners and losers, but everybody's going to be okay in the end?
The wish of every central banker and head of every treasury is that the present status quo can continue as far out as the eye can see, but certainly beyond their administration. So it's the next guy's problem. But the problem with problems is they can become a problem very, very rapidly. Sometimes there's no warning. Sometimes there's an event which happens, which you don't see coming, and you'll go from one day of normality into the next day of emergency. So things could spiral out of control very quickly. But there's no sign that it's tomorrow or next week or next year or the year after. So I'm reluctant to put a timescale on it, but I'm going to say it like this. I would be very surprised if the financial system we're living in today with dollars, pounds, euros, yen is still running in the same way 10 years from now. I don't think it's likely. And I don't think it's likely, but it's certainly not possible if we carry on with the path we're on of borrowing what is planned to be borrowed and most likely having to borrow a lot more because if you look at the budget, the US government's budget set up, which is on the Congressional Budget Office's website, you will see that they have effectively two plans. They have what's supposed to happen according to the rules and legislation, which makes a lot of assumptions. And then they have another plan that if certain tax cuts aren't cancelled, how bad it would be, a lot worse. But what they don't have is a plan which allows for the unforeseen events that we're likely to get. Unforeseen events are a recession. So that's not budgeted. If there's a recession, tax receipts go down, expenditure goes up. That's not budgeted. Pandemic, that's not budgeted. A war, that's not budgeted. And there could be lots of other things which might go wrong, which aren't in the budget, some sort of national emergency. I'm using America as the example, but it could be any country, any Western country on the planet. And if one country, Western currency goes down and has to be replaced, what do you think people in other countries are going to think? I'm not talking about some petty country, the Middle East going bust. I'm talking about a major currency like Japan, UK, somewhere in Europe like Italy, Canada. If a major currency has a panic and fails, what would you say if you hold pounds? You're going to say, well, I thought you're Britain. What you say, well, maybe we're next. What would you say if you're America? What happens if it happens to us? What are you going to do? You're probably going to go down to your bank and get the money out or change it to something else, which is already creating a sort of panic. It's sort of like the run in the cinema, the run for the exit. And that might force the government's hand to taking action very quickly.
Yeah, I've already done all of that. And I doubt that I'm the only one. I have made sure that I'm not over the FDIC limit anywhere. And one of the pieces of advice I've heard you give is don't keep too much money in the banks and in treasuries.
Right. There's no need to keep more than you might need for emergencies and for day-to-day spending. You might keep some for an opportunity which might come up. But realistically speaking, if you do keep money in the bank, while you're waiting for something to go wrong, you're going backwards by the day because the government is increasing the national debt at the present time at a rate of about 10% a year. So that is the devaluation of your wealth. If you have money in the bank, there's 10% more of it on the planet, and you're only earning 5% minus your taxes, so you end up with 3%. So you're going up by 3 when everybody else or someone else is going up by 10. So you're going backwards.
And you envision potentially fiat currencies being rebacked by gold at some point. You don't think it would be Bitcoin because governments don't own enough Bitcoin to do that. I mean, we've got El Salvador, a couple, there may be, maybe Qatar, maybe that's a rumor. But you, I'd love to know what you think about Bitcoin and also just your thoughts on potentially, I guess, our CBDC being backed by gold.
So if we have a currency reset, people will need something to trust the new currency. And the obvious choice is gold, because that is something which has always worked historically and it's a known quantity. So I think if we go into a crisis and people say, I'm not going to take the new currency unless I have some confidence in it, gold would be the backing. And of course, that's why the central banks of the world, like China and others, are all loading up on gold, because if we have a crisis, those who hold the most gold at the new Bretton Woods, if it's something equivalent, will be calling the shots, and those who have no gold will be told what to do. So I do think that backing by gold is a probability, and of course that will have to happen if we back our currencies by gold at a much, much higher level than we're at today. It depends what is backed. I mean, if we're in an extreme example, if we don't end up with giving it defaulting or abandoning the old debt under a reset, the gold would have to be, if you want to have about like one third of the currency backed by gold, you need to have something like $80,000 gold. But if you get rid of the debt and you now have just the currency in circulation, probably $4,000 gold would be probably enough, or maybe $8,000 gold, depends on where you set the bar. But of course, it's going to be a different amount in different countries, because not every country has got the same amount of gold relative to its currency as the United States have got. So some countries like Canada and Australia, they've got a lot of gold, but it's in the ground. It's not in their central bank. England hasn't got that much either. So you can imagine the revaluation of gold in some domestic currencies would be a lot higher than the 4,000 to 8,000 I quoted for the United States.
Yeah, the U.S. government hasn't allowed an audit of its gold holdings in decades. And so just in full transparency, a lot of my audience believes that many of these things were not done just because that's just the grind. The fiat currencies fail eventually, because if central bankers can print money, they do. Currency is always debased. Many people have a much more dire view of events than you do. And I'm curious, I hope this doesn't offend, because I love Europeans. I lead a retreat in Switzerland every year. I'm going to be in Switzerland with my children, husband, assistant in June and July of this year. That'll be my 10th one. I love Europeans, but I get the sense that Americans are very distraught about this, because we're so much more libertarian, more individual rights oriented. Europeans have sort of adapted to more government control than we have for many, many decades. And so that's why your take on things is fascinating to me, because you seem to sort of take it in stride. Whereas I deal with a lot of people, and I've been this way, you know, very, very distraught about seeing us heading towards the cliff. You agree or disagree with any of that?
I agree with everything you say. You know, each individual, I mean, I don't want to cause panic amongst any of your listeners or viewers. I don't think there's anything to panic about, but it's just a direction of travel. You need to make sure that you're not too exposed to the fiat money too much. But you know, there are other great things in life, like health, like your job. These are great things to have apart from money, because you know, you can have as much money as you want, but if you don't have your health, what is life?
Absolutely, which brings me full circle. That's where I've been for 18 years, is teaching people about health and wellness, because people spend their whole lives trying to gain their wealth, and then they spend their wealth trying to get their health back. And I talk to these people every day, so I completely agree with you. One quick final question. What do you think of Bitcoin, and are you investing in it?
The reason we take fiat currency, dollars, pounds, yen, the money, is because we believe that someone else will take it off us, and that person believes they'll pass it on to somebody else and for value. I believe the same thing with Bitcoin. I think that if I pass my Bitcoin to somebody else, I think it's very easy to do so. There's lots of exchanges which will change it back into spendable dollars or pounds for me. So I believe it's possible for me to pass my Bitcoin to somebody else for value. And they also believe that they would pass it or could pass it on to somebody else. And that's a network which is growing. So it doesn't really matter if it's backed by nothing at all, as is the case of the fiat currency, as is the case with Bitcoin. What matters is whether it's backed by a belief that someone will take it. So in that respect, it has value. And that the network of people who are willing to take it is growing by the day. So in Bitcoin's case, it has growing value because the network is expanding. There's many other arguments which are going on about whether Bitcoin should be banned because it consumes too much energy. Well, the fact is it does consume a lot of energy, but it's also creating a race in the world to get the cheapest energy, because unless you can manufacture Bitcoin at to a direction of travel towards zero cost, and then in the future, negative cost, you won't be making any money with Bitcoin mining. So I'm reading more and more about projects with Bitcoin. For example, there's one in Ethiopia where they're setting up building dams and things to generate power in rural areas which would never have had access to electricity because it wasn't worthwhile. But if you have a Bitcoin mining farm in the same area, now there's enough traction to produce that electricity, not only for the Bitcoin mining, but for the local village, which would never have would have had access to electricity. I'll give you another example. I was reading about a Bitcoin farm in the Netherlands, which is using solar power to power its servers. And the output of that obviously is heat, but they're pumping the heat through an indoor tulip growing farm factory. So obviously have a lot of tulip factories in the Netherlands. So the solar power is zero carbon, but by the time you're using the heat to heat up the tulip factories so the tulips grow better, it's carbon negative because the tulip factories no longer need to buy the gas which they previously burned to heat the tulips. So we're getting to a situation where there's a lot of savings and innovation being created by Bitcoin. Now, we're not at zero, and we're not at zero cost in energy at the moment, but most of the Bitcoin farms which are existing are finding ways to get that energy cost down to very low levels. And the way you get it to very low levels is either by using energy which nobody else can use, or by using energy which is taking the load when because in some forms of energy, like depending on where it is, you have high demand and low demand depending on the time of day. So at certain times of day, there's too much demand, and at certain times of day, there's not enough demand. So again, the Bitcoin rigs can be used in ways which will balance out the energy usage in a way which is profitable for the community. In other words, it reduces the cost of the electricity for the consumer, because the electricity which could otherwise have been used in the night is now being used.
Yeah.
So there's lots of it's not a one-way ticket that it's terrible. It's up for debate. So in that respect, I'm saying it's actually doing a lot of good where money talks. You've got to get the cost of electricity down to zero and then beyond zero to negative. And the last comment, which a lot of people say, is it's used for crime. And yes, it's true, there'd be lots of scams and frauds, but you only have to look at the various reports which are out there from the World Bank or from the companies which monitor these sorts of things to find out that there's a lot of fraud going on with the old style currency, whereas we know that Bitcoin itself is fully traceable. You can't get it in or out of the system without it being attached to an individual with a name, address, and passport. Whereas the old fiat dollars, which pass through the streets, are completely anonymous.
Yeah, very, very well said. My short way of saying those two things is that Bitcoin, maybe some miners are working in New York City on the heavily taxed energy grid, the electrical grid, but they could be using excess energy that isn't being used, is being squandered somewhere else. And yes, that's the argument. Bitcoin is used by criminals, but actually the US dollar is how a lot of criminals move money, and there's not the traceability of the blockchain. So
I would say the one thing to warn thing about Bitcoin, it's if you need to change place rapidly, perhaps because you've got civil unrest and your house is being ransacked and people are stealing your furniture, stealing everything you've got, the banks are all shut their doors because of rioting. Well, you can move from place to place with your Bitcoin in your head. You can leave the borders, you can cross the border to another country. Nobody knows that you've got your Bitcoin in your head. And when you arrive in the safe place, you can then cash it in. That's one of the key advantages of Bitcoin.
And I would encourage everyone to memorize their seed phrases, because it's in your brain. And not that that's the only place that you should have it, but then that's one of the many advantages. Well, you are absolutely brilliant. I'm going to get your review of David Rogers Webb's short book called The Great Taking from LinkedIn, and I'll share it with everyone. But meantime, I know it's late where you are. I'm so grateful for the time you've given us. That was just absolutely wonderful. Thank you so much, Clive, and I will get back to you soon and hope to talk to you again soon. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much, Robin. I see we've done an hour and a half. So if you want to break that into two, that's fine. I'll leave that up to you to decide whether you split it.
No, it's an hour and a half class. But when you said you could go longer than an hour, I took advantage of that. So very, very grateful, my friend. Have a good night.
Thank you very much for having me. Bye-bye, Robin. And thumbs up all your listeners.
Okay, bye now.
Bye now.